Posso estar por aí? Topic of our Dhamma talk this evening is the hindrances. The hindrances that are familiar to you as meditators or not? Yes. So, hindrances that tend to occur during the meditation practice, intensive meditation practice, but also outside of intensive practice. Now, to start with a story, and the story is not entirely based on imagination, but rather based on the experiences of at least two, possibly even three people. Now, coming to a retreat is something that at times may happen quite smoothly, at other times may be full of hindrances. Now the story is as follows. 2 years ago, when, and I'm shaping the story a little bit, when a retreatant living in the greater Los Angeles area decided to go on a retreat here in New Mexico, and back then it was at the retreat was to be held at the Synergia Ranch, not too far from Santa Fe. So this retreatant intended to fly from one of the regional airports in the greater Los Angeles area via Las Vegas to where? Albuquerque. Now, the flight was supposed to be relatively early in the morning, and so even though departure was quite some time ahead of departure from the home, was quite some time before in proper time, yet it so happened that already early in the morning there was some very dense traffic on the interstate leading to the airport. And so getting to the airport was already a matter causing some nervousness. Will we make it or not? Fortunately, our retreatant made it to the airport and just barely made the check-in, and then when it came to the security check, well, the usual thing, the bags got screened, and on top of this, the security officers felt it was necessary to do a full body check. So, which of course takes more time, and which then makes reaching the flight in time more difficult. But by the virtue of the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, our retreatant just made it to the gate. And so just before the boarding ended. So our retreatant is looking forward to the retreat at the Synergia Ranch, and then is sitting in the plane, and then waiting for the plane to take off. And what happened was, here comes an announcement by the captain. Here's your captain speaking. Sorry to say, because of a thunderstorm that is just approaching near the airport, our departure will be delayed by 20 minutes, or by some time, approximately 20 minutes. So our retreatant patiently waits, sitting there. The plane is still on the tarmac, and indeed the thunderstorm does occur, and there are quite a number of lightnings that strike, and then it even rains a little bit, and so all of this obviously adds to the discomfort of our retreatant. Now, Fortunately, the thunderstorm is not lasting forever, just a very short one. And finally, the captain picks up the microphone and says, "Now, folks, we're ready to take off." And so then the plane takes off. And then the flight to Las Vegas is without any problem. However, owing to a delayed, owing to the delayed departure, well, getting into Las Vegas is on time or delayed. Well, obviously also delayed. And since the transfer time between the incoming flight and the outgoing flight to start with was already rather short, well, the delay from the first flight and then adds or plays an important role. So our passenger, our retreatant, who's very eager to make it to the retreat, well, he runs as best as he can to make the connection from the LA flight to the ongoing flight to Albuquerque. Now, he makes it, but what about the luggage? So wait and see whether the piece of luggage is going to make it or not. So finally, the second flight takes off, and then everything is okay, except just before reaching Albuquerque, the stewardess comes and says, "Please put your carry-on baggage underneath the seat of the seat in front, and with this the retreatant." Then misplaces his hat, and then when after the plane has landed and the time comes to get up, well, that woolen hat ends up on the floor and gets forget, and ends up staying there. So then upon reaching the carousel in order to pick up the suitcase, well, too bad. No suitcase there. And did you experience something like this? And so then it means that our retreatant has to rush over to the what is this called, the unclaimed
baggage
claim. There you go, the baggage claim counter, and so then all the details have to be registered, and then the person in charge does assure our retreatant that there's no need to worry, the luggage will be safely delivered to the retreat center outside of Santa Fe. Okay, now, so far so good. However, our retreatant was supposed to catch the shuttle bus. And there's just one shuttle bus going from Albuquerque towards the retreat center at the Synergier Ranch. Unfortunately, that shuttle bus is gone already. And there's only one single one. So this then means then our retreatant has to make other arrangements, and certain private arrangements, namely he has to look for a cab. So finally, outside of the Albuquerque airport, he spots a cab, and then talks to the cab driver, asks him whether he knows the Synergier Ranch near outside of Santa Fe, where the retreat is supposed to take place. The cab driver with much confidence says, "Oh, well, surely I know that place. How could I not know?" And so then our retreatant has full confidence in the cab driver, and so both of them take off for the Synergier Ranch. And suddenly, so the drive takes about how long? Maybe an hour, slightly over an hour. Yes, and so it, and then finally, some rather remote place is reached, and so the cab driver tells the retreatant, "So here we are. This is the Synergia Ranch." The retreatant gets out of the taxi, walks up to the facilities there, and then talks to the person at the office to find out what.
Uh-uh.
This is not the Synergia Ranch. Sorry, sir, you're in the wrong place. The retreat is not going to take place here, but somewhere else. And so then you have to convince your cab driver to go to the true Synergia Ranch. So finally, our retreatant does reach the proper destination, and then after a couple of hours of waiting, then also the airline brings the missing suitcase. Now, this story is pretty much based on actual occurrences, an actual event. And as for the last part, it was Victor Bird who took a taxi in Italy, and intending to go to the meditation center in Pian di Ciliegi, which is south of Piacenza, and it so happens that nearby there's also a Goenka retreat center. The taxi driver only knew the Goenka center. He thought, well, there's just this one single meditation center, and so he happily drove Victor Bird to the Goenka center, and then poor Victor, after a while, he figured out that he was in the wrong place. And so traveling to a retreat center at times can be full of hindrances. Now, it doesn't end there. Once you've settled in, you've been given a room at the center, you unpack and maybe take a shower, and then it's time for the manager talk, and then shortly after that it's time for the opening talk, and then you hear the meditation instructions. So far so good, and then with lots of energy you start practicing, and you assume that it's going to be smooth practice, sailing along happily. But what? Well, things are not that easy. And so, after just a few days of intensive practice, as retreatants, we discover that all sorts of hindrances come up. Can you think of some? Some that you've experienced yourselves within the last couple of days? Aversion, yes. What else? Dullness. What else?
Sloth and torpor.
Sloth and torpor, yes.
Desire.
Desire for what? To end the retreat?
Could be.
So, if not that, then... Pardon me, too?
Better practice.
Or better practice. And for some, it could be desire for... Well, for special, the type of food that you're used to at home, or it could, well, around here, for more comfort, there couldn't be more comfort. So not that one. So, anyways, a desire might suddenly come up, and sudden aversion, ill will might arise. Sloth and torpor, dullness is part of this, and then. Have we really mentioned all forms of difficulties or hindrances? Doubt, yes. And this doubt might be a major one. and might actually cause a meditator or cause meditators much trouble. And then apart from doubt, there's still another hindrance left.
Restlessness
and remorse. So then Lin basically covers the most important hindrances, even though, or having said this, there's actually several sets of hindrances that are mentioned in the text, and there's one set in which another mental quality is being mentioned, which is fundamental to all of those that you have mentioned so far. So which quality, which mental factor is this that is underlying all of the others?
Delusion,
there you go. Delusion or ignorance. And so all of the others are based in delusion. Now, these hindrances, typically speaking, arise in the course of our meditation practice, arise after... Let's say for a new meditator, arise within just a few days of intensive practice. So typically, maybe day 3, day 4, day 5. And so then, this happens as part of the development of the first insight knowledge. And once one has overcome the hindrances, does it mean that they're gone forever? Not at all. And so there are ample of opportunities to deal with those hindrances over and over again. So they do tend to arise again in what is known as the knowledge by comprehension, which is the third insight knowledge. And then they also tend to arise again at a later point in the practice, a place known as the knowledge of reobservation, which is the tenth insight knowledge. And there too, the hindrances can cause a meditator much headache. Now, hindrances occur not only on the way to a retreat center, not only during intensive practice, but even in worldly life. Can you think of a particular situation in life where the hindrances might arise? Chris?
Walking past the garlic bread.
Walking past the
garlic bread.
Oh, the garlic bread. Oh, I see. So then, what happens? Then desire arises. Yes. And can you think of any other life situation where the hindrances might arise?
Ill will in traffic all the time.
In traffic all the time. Yes. Yeah. Correct.
In conversation with someone.
In conversation with others.
Yes, it can just come up.
Such as?
It could come up ill will very subtly.
Yes. Okay.
Through wrong speech.
Yes. Okay. And then... And a couple of years back, I read a small publication which was published by the Buddhist Text Society in Kandy, Sri Lanka, and it was about the hindrances and the married life. Do you see any connection there? Do you think there's any? No? Alan?
It's a learning process.
Oh, I see. And so according to the author of that small booklet, if I remember correctly, he's a psychologist. And the point he's making is that the hindrances also occur in married life. And so, when we deal with our spouse or partner, at times our dealings will be influenced by liking, at other times by disliking, so desire and ill will, and then at other times If we've had enough of this liking and disliking business, then we might certainly feel somewhat less energetic to get involved in a conversation. We might not want to interact with the other person anymore, and so we keep it certainly everything to a minimum. Or having to deal with the other person might suddenly then cause a lot of restlessness. So our spouse is talking to us, but we really don't want to listen. And suddenly so then we busy ourselves reading the newspaper or watching TV or giving only half answers. Yes? It's true or not?
Yeah.
Oh yes. Oh, I see. And then sooner or later, so having with restlessness and remorse having arisen, and we then deal with it, but then doubting thoughts might arise. Is this really the ultimate relationship or not? And so then second thoughts might certainly come up. Now, from a Buddhist perspective, these hindrances, what do you think? Should we treat them as ultimates, or should we deal with them in a realistic manner and be mindful of them? Well, I suppose mindfulness is the proper answer. So if we take these hindrances too seriously, then indeed the relationship might certainly suffer unnecessarily. Now, the hindrances certainly have been mentioned. So hindrance of sense desire, ill will, restlessness, and sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, and skeptical doubt in the Pali scriptural language. These are known as Kamachanda Nivarana, as Vyapada Nivarana, as Tinamida Nivarana, as Udicca Kukuccha Nivarana, and then finally as Vicikicca Nivarana. Now, later on, we shall explore why these particular mental states are referred to as hindrances. Now, the Buddha has certainly given at least three similes for a better understanding of those hindrances. The first one is certainly that of seeing or looking into a vessel which is filled certainly with water and trying to see the reflection in the water, and trying to see one's own reflection in the water. So using this vessel filled with water kind of as a mirror. Now, the hindrance of sense desire in this simile is compared to what?
Colored
water, there you go. That is certainly correct. And the hindrance of ill will then is compared to what kind of water?
Uno?
Boiling water, there you go. And so when the water is boiling in that vessel of in that certain vessel, then will it be easy to see one's reflection? Kim? Not easy, right? And certainly then what would be the illustration for sloth and torpor? So you're trying to see your reflection in water, but
murky
water, well, not quite. What's how did the Buddha construct the illustration?
Muddy?
That's the example for doubt. There you go. Muddy, murky water is the same. So, does anyone remember? algae with mosses covering near the surface of the water. So, if the mosses are covering the surface of the water, how can you possibly see your own reflection in it? Now, in the case of restlessness and remorse, it's maybe more obvious. This is being compared to water that is
turbulent.
Yes, agitated by the wind, whipped up by some strong wind. So, which means that the surface of our vessel, or the surface of the water, is rather agitated and wavy, shaky, and with this thing, you cannot properly see your own reflection in it. And the last part of our illustration or simile, we've covered already. So it's water that is muddy, murky, and in this it's very difficult to see your own reflection. So that's a beautiful illustration. Now, there is yet another one, namely that of gold, which is impaired by various impurities. And so, in the case of a goldsmith who's trying to make some ornament or a necklace out of gold, which is impaired by iron or copper or tin or lead or silver or a combination of these, what do you think? Will it be easy for the goldsmith to do his work or her work?
No.
Not easy. Because gold that is still full of these impurities will not be pliant, will not be wieldy, and will also lack radiance, will be brittle, which means it breaks easily, and then will be very difficult to work with. Likewise for the mind. A mind in which the five hindrances arise is a mind that is very difficult to work with. It's a mind that is not pliant, that is not wieldy, that is not radiant, and not firm, and that cannot be wrought well. And so it follows from this that a mind that is free from the five hindrances, from the five impurities, will be a mind that is radiant and that can be very well worked with. Now, can you, from your own experiences, meditative experiences, can you give reasons why the hindrances are known as hindrances? Why are spoken of so badly?
Because they distort the way we see things.
Yes.
Cloud our entire viewpoint.
Yes, this is very correct. They cloud our understanding of the true nature of objects, indeed. Any other reasons?
We tend to capture the attention and take it away from the present.
Yes, that's correct too. Anything else?
If the hindrances seem to be the major components.
Yes. That is correct too. So they lead to a certain stagnation in our practice. So
like they're the mother of reactivity, and so they would come out in speech and body and speech.
This is also a good observation. So, in in a general manner, one can say that suddenly these hindrances are, well, they hinder, for one thing, the development of concentration in the context of our samatha meditation, so calm meditation. They make it difficult, you know, for a meditator, you know, to gain the jhanas, the absorptions, and they make it difficult to reach neighborhood concentration and full concentration. And in terms of insight meditation, the Vipassana meditation, they hinder a realization of peace of Nibbana, or they make it difficult to discern objects clearly, to discern the truth. Now, in quite a number of passages, one passage from the Digha Nikaya, at least three passages from the Samyutta Nikaya, and several other texts, the five hindrances are spoken of as defilements of the mind, cittaso upakilise, and those five hindrances are further referred to as weakening wisdom, weakening our ability to intuitively understand the true nature of formations. Now, there is a very interesting connection between the hindrances and the enlightenment factors. And so the Bodhyanga Samyutta, the collection of discourses on the enlightenment factors, establishes an antithesis between the seven enlightenment factors and the five hindrances. And so, there's not just one single passage that speaks of this, but even in several. And so the hindrances are the obstacles to meditative progress in both concentration as well as insight meditation. And they are described, for instance, not only in the Samyutta Nikaya, but also in the Digha Nikaya and Majjhima Nikaya, as part of the gradual path of training. And later on, I will quote a little bit. Now, the hindrances are comparable. Well, we've seen to corruptions of gold, and as another simile, to parasitic forest trees, and then, as we've seen, impurities in water which obscure the reflection of one's satna face. Furthermore, those same hindrances are said to be makers of blindness, destructive to wisdom, and distractions from the path to Nibbana. They are also, to put this last point differently, they are said to block the arising of knowledge as well as the arising of the, or gaining the realization of the happiness of Nibbana. Now, on the other hand, the enlightenment factors are being praised as acids, as makers of vision and knowledge, promoters of wisdom, as aids along the path to Nibbana. In one section, it says that the enlightenment factors lead to knowledge and vision, whereas the hindrances lead to an absence of knowledge and vision. Now, in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middling discourses of the Buddha, we find in discourse number 108, we find an interesting passage that speaks of a conversation, or that describes a conversation between Elder Ananda and a Brahmin by the name of Visakara, if I remember correctly. And the Brahmin is asking about different types of meditation, and Elder Ananda then replies what the Blessed One considers proper meditation, forms of meditation, and other forms of meditation that the Buddha or the Blessed One does not consider as proper meditations. Could you think of a meditation that is not proper meditation?
Wrong view is present.
Meditating with wrong view, yes, you could say this. Anything else? Well, very simple. If, and this is happening, even among insight meditators, if a meditator sits in meditation with eyes closed, straight back, perfect posture, full lotus, and the outward impression is, oh, this is really a model meditator. But in the mind, this meditator is thinking sensual thoughts. Not just one, but two, but three, but four, but the whole sitting, non-stop. So, this, the Buddha, does not consider as proper meditation. So, to give you, or to quote from that particular passage, Ananda is saying, the Blessed One, O Brahman, did not praise every type of meditation, nor did he condemn every type of meditation. What kind of meditation did the Blessed One not praise? Here, someone abides with his or her mind, obsessed by sensual lust, a prey to sensual lust, and does not understand, as it actually is, the escape from arisen sensual lust. While one harbors sensual lust within, one meditates, premeditates, outmeditates, and mismeditates. So, this form of a meditation could be considered, or has to be considered, as a form of mismeditating in the Pali scripture language known as appajayanti. The same thing then goes or applies for the other hindrances. So if one enjoys thinking aversive thoughts, or if one enjoys sitting there and suddenly sleeping, and one spends one's time this, then this would be a case of mismeditating. And so the Buddha does not recommend this kind of meditation, but rather does he recommend or he praises forms of meditation such as jhana practice, and obviously also proper insight meditation. So, if one were to spend most of one's time just engaging in sensual thoughts or in aversive thoughts, etc., then this will not lead to the purification of the mind. Now, there are different means of overcoming the hindrances. And can you think of any such means?
Concentration?
Yes, concentration helps to suppress the hindrances. Anything else?
Investigation.
Yes, investigation of what?
The hindrances.
Investigation of the hindrances, yes, indeed. And to add, the enlightenment factor of investigation of states, Dhamma Vijjhatna Sambojanga, is indeed given as an antithesis to, skeptical doubt. Yes?
Loving kindness,
yes, in which context?
Well, maybe that can help with the hatred.
Yes, that is correct. Anything else?
Meditation on the different parts of the body to help with the sensual desire?
Yes, it's also correct. And so. Yes? Mindfulness, there you go. And actually, mindfulness is for each and every of those five hindrances, the first one. The first way, the first and foremost way to deal with it. And so, if you don't know of any other way of overcoming a hindrance, do remember mindfulness. And so, simply to be mindful of the arising of a hindrance, the presence of a hindrance, and the passing away of a hindrance. And then also, in the context of the Dhammanupassana Satipatthana, and Marcia will talk about this satna tomorrow, there is mindfulness of mindfulness of the aggregates, and then also mindfulness of the hindrances. And so in this context, knowing the conditions that lead to the arising, and if a hindrance is present, knowing the conditions that lead to the removal, and once the hindrance has been removed, knowing the conditions that prevent a future arising of the respective hindrance. So mindfulness very much is an important way to tackle the hindrances. And now, investigation of states was already mentioned as one way of overcoming the hindrances. Can you think of another enlightenment factor that specifically targets one hindrance? Yes, please, Paul.
Energy
overcomes what? And that, yes, so the enlightenment factor of energy, virya, sambojanga, then may help us to overcome the hindrance of sloth and torpor. And so then, what about restlessness and remorse? Do you see any antithesis for this?
Tranquility,
that is correct. Pasadi. So pasadi sambojanga as a way of overcoming restlessness and remorse, udicca and kukucca. Now, interesting is that the Samyutta Nikaya in its fifth volume, section 60, also mentions the Eightfold Noble Path as a way of overcoming the hindrances. And so there, it's a short discourse that first just mentions the hindrances, and then in the last part it says, this noble eightfold path is to be developed for direct knowledge of these five hindrances, for the full full understanding of them, and for their utter destruction, for their abandoning. So based on this passage, we can say that training in the Eightfold Noble Path would be another way of dealing with the hindrances when they come up. Now, in terms of individual mental factors that are helpful to overcome the hindrances, Sharmila has mentioned concentration, and then I think Paul mentioned mindfulness, and yet there's another very important, and well, and then there's already there's another factor that you've mentioned already, namely energy or effort, right? So our teacher from Burma, the Venerable Sadhu Upandita Biwamsa, very much or frequently mentions those three factors as being essential to overcoming the hindrances. The way he explains this is that the mental factor of effort, viriya, will distance the hindrances, will distance the mental defilements in general, will block their arising. Now, in the case of mindfulness, what's the action of mindfulness?
It penetrates
an object, yes.
Through the delusion of the hindrances.
Yes, and more specifically.
Sometimes you can get caught in there, like you recognize it as it starts, so you don't get as wrapped up in it.
We're getting there.
Remember?
What's the second manifestation of mindfulness? The first one is being face to face with the object of observation, and the second one is
staying with it.
Being with it.
Staying with it.
Staying with it.
So. Penetrating.
The protection of the mind. Araka pachupatana. And so protection of the mind from the attack by mental defilements, and in a general sense, and in particular from the hindrances. So in the presence of moment-to-moment mindfulness, and there not being any gaps of absent-mindedness, then how can unwholesome mental states arise? They cannot arise. And thus, so in the presence of mindfulness, the hindrances cannot arise, and the mind will be protected. Now, in the case of concentration, its work is, or its function is, to suppress the hindrances. So, suppressing the hindrances then means that they're gone once and forever. Amen. Only momentarily. So as long as the power of concentration is there, as long as that suppression power is there, the hindrances have no chance to create havoc. But when your concentration, your samadhi weakens, then the hindrances might suddenly spring back up. Now, I think you mentioned earlier on vitakka and vichara. So, indeed, the Venerable Sadhu Pandita also mentions in particular vitakka as a way of dealing with the hindrances. Now, his way of explanation is as follows. And vitakka and which are in particular in connection with sloth and torpor. So, when sloth and torpor is present in the mind, then the mind will do what?
Contract.
It will contract, it will congeal, it will become rather stiff, like a stick of butter that you've kept in the freezer for a long period of time. And so it is with proper aiming the mind at the center of the predominant object, that then gradually the mind opens up, that constricted mind then opens up, and then becomes more active, and with this then sloth and torpor may subside. And obviously, in this connection, effort will also play an important role. And it's what effort does is the way the Venerable Sayadaw explains it. Is the burning, the heat of effort will melt those hindrances, and then will activate the mind. The heat of effort then will activate the mind and drive that sloth and torpor away. Now, just for general knowledge, the Melinda Panhas, the questions of Melinda, in section 34, mentions faith, saddha, as a way or a means of overcoming the hindrances. And the explanation is as follows, namely, as confidence springs up in the mind, it breaks through the veil of the hindrances. Now, maybe to explain this a little bit further, but this is guesswork, and I'm honest about this. When one has overcome, or let's say, among the hindrances, it is the hindrance of doubt that usually arises as the last one. And so if one has applied mindfulness to doubt, then gradually the doubt will subside, and eventually faith will arise, confidence will arise. And with this, then one heads out of the zone of the hindrances and into a zone of more wholesome mental states. So that's my personal reading of this, but this may not be necessarily what the commentaries say. Now, what are, from your experience, the results of overcoming the hindrances? Is there any benefit to this?
You get stronger each time you successfully overcome a hindrance. Your mindfulness, your confidence, your faith, all of it gets stronger.
Yes, this is very good indeed. And it is not just a meditation experience, but even a life experience. Whenever we have to face some challenge in life, be it in our work life, or our life at work, or in the field of education, let's say we've got some really difficult exams ahead of us, or maybe in the arena of sports, athletics, if we've got some very tough competition ahead of us, and in order to move ahead, we have to give our very best, and we have to muster all of our physical and mental strength to then pass the test. And the result is, just like you're saying correctly, that the mind will be strengthened in terms of effort, in terms of mindfulness, in terms of concentration, and certainly indeed confidence. That once we've passed the test, we know we can do it. And then we're ready to face the next challenge. And so that's one result that comes certainly with overcoming the hindrances. A few results are there.
Gladness.
What's that?
Gladness.
Yes, indeed, this is correct, Satna, too. So the mind is glad to have overcome the hindrances, and oftentimes not just the hindrances, but also physical pains. Sometimes meditators go through some very severe physical pains, and so having to work with them, eventually overcoming the pains, then leads to a general sense of gladness. I've done it. No? I've done it, I've managed to go beyond these physical as well as mental difficulties. And the arising of gladness then quite naturally leads to the arising of which other wholesome mental state?
Joy,
yes. And concentration. And prior to the concentration, between the joy and concentration, we have?
Sukha.
Sukha, yes. And between sukha and joy?
Tranquility.
There you go. So, there is a well-known passage in the Digha Nikaya and possibly also in other places that speaks of a very common sequence, namely the arising of the, or the overcoming of the hindrances then leads to the arising of gladness. The gladness in turn leads to the arising of joy. The joy, when at first it's somewhat rough and coarse, gradually becomes more and more refined. This leads to the arising of the calming or stilling of the body. In turn, this leads to the stilling of the mind, which then prepares the ground for the arising of happiness. When there is happiness, the mind or the happiness is the proximate cause for the arising of concentration. And concentration, in turn, then is suddenly the ground for insight, for wisdom. And so there's a whole this series of wholesome states that suddenly becomes suddenly possible, or that arises owing to the overcoming of the hindrances. Now, Sharmila, you have mentioned that the mind gets strengthened. We can add by saying the mind overall becomes more stable. And so if you think later on in the practice, especially during the 10th insight knowledge, when the hindrances are at work, they can be very strong. And they can literally cause a meditator's body to shake and to swing and sway in this direction, that direction. So there's a lot of turbulence going on first in the mind and then also manifesting in the body. And at that point, the mind is clearly not balanced, and it's the mind gets thrown from one opposite to the other, from one extreme to the other, and this physically then also or manifests also physically. And so, once a meditator has overcome the hindrances, then all of these extremes are no longer valid. And so, with this, the mind becomes much more stable, and so, then also more resilient and unshaken. So there's a number of good things that result from overcoming the hindrances. Now, allow me to quote the a passage, more or less similar passage, on the overcoming of the five hindrances. And the two passages are number one from the Digha Nikaya, volume 1, section 71, 72, 73, and corresponding to this, Majjhima Nikaya 1, section 181. And I'm quoting, "One has cast away sense desire, kamachanda. One dwells with a heart free from sense desire. From sense desire, one cleanses one's heart. One has cast away aversion, vyapada. One dwells with a heart free from aversion. Cherishing love and compassion toward all living beings, one cleanses one's heart from aversion. One has cast away sloth and torpor, tina mida. One dwells free from sloth and torpor, loving the light with watchful mind, with clear comprehension. One cleanses one's mind from sloth and torpor. One has cast away restlessness and remorse, udicca, kukucca, dwelling with a mind undisturbed, with a heart full of peace. One cleanses one's mind from restlessness and remorse. One has cast away doubt, vicikicca, dwelling free from doubt, full of confidence in the good. One cleanses one's heart from doubt. So, apart from the results that we've mentioned or explored so far, there are others like confidence and loving kindness, compassion, etc. Now it's already past 8 o'clock. A little bit, just maybe to say a few things about one of the hindrances. So, so far we've spoken about the hindrances in general, and now let's pick sloth and torpor, since this sloth and torpor for sure has strongly hit some of our meditators here, including myself. And now, for a better understanding of fitness, sloth, and torpor, the Dhamma Sanghani, which is the first Abhidhamma work, describes sloth, in Pali known as tina, by using the following synonyms. Namely, it says, sloth is indisposition of mind, unpreparedness of mind for good action, and please notice, for good action, not for unwholesome action, sluggishness of mind, stolidity of mind, inertia of mind, inertness of mind, being inert, sloth, being slothful, slothfulness of mind. This is called sloth. And modern synonyms for this would be dullness of mind, laziness, idleness, disinclination to action or labor, indolence, laze, the bad habit of being lazy and unwilling to work, and certainly then the state of having no energy or enthusiasm. Now, as a short definition, we can say sloth is sluggishness or the dullness of the mind. In terms of the classical fourfold definition, sloth has the characteristic of the lack of a driving power. So there's no energy to move ahead, no motivation to go and do something. Now, the function of fatna sloth is to do what? Each mental factor has a certain function. And in the case of sloth, it is to dispel energy. So just like energy gets you moving, in the case of fatna sloth, it is to remove fatna the energy, and satna then to turn you into a lethargic being. Now, this sloth is manifests as the sinking of the mind. This is what the texts say. And this is very much based on actual experience of meditators. When when the mind gets overcome by sloth, then we find that the level of mental activity is decreasing more and more, and there's a clear sense of sinking in the mind. So if you notice this, then know that this is the mental state of sloth being predominant in your mind. Now, the proximate cause for the arising of this sloth is unwise attention to boredom, drowsiness, sluggishness of mind, and dullness of mind. So you sit in meditation with eyes closed and with a slouched posture, and you're in this sudden, somewhat dreamy state, and you think it's perfectly all right to let this state go on and on and on. And so accepting it, tolerating it, and that suddenly then tolerating the boredom, and that then leads to the arising of sloth.
Recognition has to precede the tolerance. The tolerance is a sign that I'm identified.
Yeah, right. And
so there has to be a recognition.
There you go. That's correct. And so with all of the hindrances, recognizing a hindrance, recognizing sense desire and ill will as ill will, already makes a huge difference. If you know that the mind is overcome by this or that hindrance, then you've won half the battle. And so then it's just a matter of continuously applying mindfulness and also exerting effort in making sure that the mind is concentrated, and then gradually the respective hindrance will subside. I know. But if one sits there and doesn't even recognize that one or the other hindrance is creating havoc in the mind, well, one is going to lose the battle.
And I could see you could confuse it with tranquility. For instance, you think you're tranquil, it's a passivity that you're sinking into.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And so, experienced meditators, but with new meditators, they think, well, all I need to do is just observe the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, and that's it. And they don't, when restlessness has arisen, they think it's quite okay, it's quite natural, so why be mindful of this? And then they keep being restless for a long period of time. And then finally, maybe because a teacher is asking, or they find out themselves, and then finally they start being mindful of it. Now, somewhat close to the sloth is torpor, which in the Pali scripture language is known as middha. And suddenly here, this sudden torpor is or gets explained in the Dhammasangani as indisposition of the mental factors. So in the case of sloth, it was an indisposition of the mind. Here, now it's indisposition of mental factors, unpreparedness of mental factors for good actions, obscurity of mental factors, internal blockage of mental factors, torpor, sleepiness, drowsiness, being sleepiness. This is called torpor. And modern expressions for this would be lethargy, mental inertness, lassitude, sleep, slumber, stupor, torpidity, and a state of not being active. And now, the short definition for torpor is a morbid state of mental factors. Its characteristic is unwieldiness, its function is to smother, and it is manifested as drooping, as tiredness, as nodding, as exhaustion, as drowsiness, as sleepiness. And the proximate cause is sudden, as given earlier, unwise attention to boredom, and so on. Now, unwise attention to boredom and certain others were given as proximate causes for sloth and torpor. Can you think of other factors that contribute to sloth and torpor in the meditation practice?
Lack of effort at really
grasping or aiming for the object?
Yes, so effort, and then you're saying also aiming. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's correct. What else?
Mindfulness.
Absence of not enough mindfulness, yes, it's correct. Let's say.
Things like eating and sleeping too much? Or
there you go, that is correct. Sleeping too much, and in general we can say eating too much. And among food items, there are certain types of food that contribute more towards sleepiness than others. And you know, like my personal experience has been eating lots of potatoes, creates a certain amount of sleepiness. So does drinking much milk. I know.
But how do we know the difference between what's normal sleepiness, your body just telling you that you need more sleep, and sloth and torpor, especially in the early stages of meditation?
How do we know this? Well, let's say if everyone else follows the schedule and we go to bed maybe 2 hours earlier, then maybe this is a case of sloth and torpor.
The other side though, is not getting enough sleep causes sloth and torpor.
That might also be a factor. Yes?
Some people push themselves hard to not
sleep. Yes.
Right.
Or
lack of energy.
Yes, is correct. Or what's here in our case, in the case of Viranyani, being totally jet lagged, and so we'll flying across the Pacific, across different time zones, certainly will take several days to get over the jet lag. And then we have those who, let's say, have really active jobs, and maybe as a manager, this or that, and there's a lack of sleep that builds up over just weeks and months, and one is maybe not really realizing it, because one is certainly keeping awake by drinking lots of coffee, energizing the mind. And then one comes on a retreat, and then one falls asleep. And then the body is catching up, the body and mind is catching up, and it's showing in the form of sloth and torpor. So that's also one has to take into account. Now, there are, from a general point of view, during the early stages of practice, we tend to need a lot of sleep. But when we take the case of a more advanced meditator who, in his or her practice, has gone quite far, let's say, is experiencing some of the advanced or higher insight knowledges, we find that such a meditator gets by with much less sleep. Let's say, just 4 hours of sleep, sometimes even less. And during the day, the person doesn't feel sleepy. So, why is this? Why is there this difference between sleep?
Because it refreshes the mind to have that calm and clarity, and so you need less sleep.
Yes. To add to your explanation, the frequent occurrence of mental impurities, of mental defilements, tires the mind, exhausts the mind. Whereas, with further practice, more advanced practice, less and less mental impurities are arising as a result of this, more and more wholesome mental states are present, and we get by with less sleep. So the presence or absence of mental defilements may make a big difference or very much determine our need for sleep. And some meditators who've practiced quite a bit and gone really, really deep, they easily get by with just 2 hours of sleep. It's not uncommon. Obviously, one cannot do this forever, but when the practice is at a certain point. Now, sleep and or sloth and torpor and external conditions such as climate or temperature also plays a role. So if you happen to meditate in a place where the temperature that rises to, let's say, 95 degrees Fahrenheit or even more than this, maybe 100 degrees, then what about your mind? Will it be super alert all the time? Obviously not. So this can be easily experienced in places like Nepal and India and Burma and Africa and so on. On the other hand, when you're in a place like here in the States during this month, so it's not that hot yet, this is quite good, it's a good condition for practice. Now, obviously when we fall sick, we will also need more sleep. And so then sloth and torpor may easily come up. Now, another interesting point that ties in with what we've discussed earlier on, the Dhammapada Atthagatha as well as the Dhammapada verses 112 and 230 say that the frequent arising of sensuous thoughts, kama vitakka, the frequent arising of thoughts of ill will, vyapada vitakka, and the thoughts of cruelty, vihimsa vitakka, also create sloth and torpor, or contribute to the arising of sloth and torpor. So thinking unwholesome thoughts will tire the mind and then lead to sloth and torpor. Now, when sloth and torpor is present, then this is already bad enough. But it gets actually worse. When sloth and torpor are present, then this will frequently, or the laziness, will frequently be combined with several other unwholesome states of mind, such as lack of faith, asaddha, lack of moral shame, ahirika, lack of moral fear, little learning, and lack of wisdom or folly, dupanya, in the Pali scriptural language. And so what we have to be aware of is that in the presence of laziness and by extension sloth and torpor, there's a fair chance for other unwholesome mental states to arise and to make life even more difficult. Now, sloth, according to the Abhidhamma, is a mental state that arises together with the seven universals, and sometimes with five, sometimes with six occasionals, and always together with the four unwholesome universals, such as ignorance, and then lack of moral shame, fearlessness of wrongdoing, and then restlessness. Sometimes it will be accompanied by greed, sometimes without wrong view, sometimes with or without conceit, sometimes with hate, sometimes also with avarice and worry. And sloth, for sure, does not arise with beautiful mental states. So sloth is certainly a mental state that certainly we do not want to cherish for or welcome for too much or too long. Now, different ways to deal with sloth and torpor. There are many of those, mindfulness being the first, and then knowing that overeating may lead to sloth and torpor, so regulating the amount of food, moderation in food, being careful with what one eats. And then an interesting point is, if in sitting meditation, sitting after sitting, you fall asleep, then what would be the answer to this?
Go to sleep.
What's that? Go to sleep. Well, that might be one answer. But what's that?
Stand up.
To stand up, there you go. Change the posture. In standing, there will be a less likelihood to fall asleep. Although sometimes there are cases of extreme sloth and torpor where one still falls asleep or almost falls over. Moving, yes, indeed, walking meditation, and the texts also mention walking outside at nighttime, looking at the sky, and then there are things like establishing the perception of light. Now, some meditators are gifted and have this talent of being able, with eyes closed, they manage to arouse or create a light in the mind, so a bright light. And when this bright light arises, then it dispels the sloth and torpor. Now, once in Lumbini, we had such a meditator, and she just didn't have any problems with sloth at all, and sloth and torpor at all. Staying in the open air, you might also want to seek the association with an energetic person, and then you might want to listen to a Dhamma talk on sloth and torpor or the hindrances. Now, let me conclude today's Satna Dhamma talk by wishing, may we all apply those different ways Satna mentioned in the text, or mentioned so far, to overcome sloth and torpor and Satna, all of the other hindrances. And in particular, in the case of sloth and torpor, may we take to heart the advice Satna given by the Buddha to elder Mahamoggallana, who simple forms did not help to overcome the sloth and torpor. And eventually, we gain the path of arahantship, and with this, dispel sloth and torpor forever. And may this happen during this very lifetime. And this is it for now. And so the fact that it takes arahantship shows you how difficult it is to get rid of sloth and torpor. So sloth and torpor will be around for a little bit longer. It's not
so. One question, Seidel. In my mind, I had always associated the rains retreat, which is during the monsoon season.
Yes.
As a traditional time when the monks go into retreat.
Yeah, right.
And obviously the temperature will be high, the humidity.
Not so high.
Not so high?
No, at the very beginning of the the rains retreat, at least in Burma, and also in Nepal, and it's going to be hot and humid. I know, but later on, the temperature does drop a bit. Somewhat.
In terms of sloth and torpor, it must be extremely difficult. I mean, the conditions are.
At least not as bad as the hot season.
When is the hot season?
The hot season is March, April, May, June.
Before the monsoon.
Yeah, before the monsoon. Yeah. And then it gets really hot.
Really?
Oh, the monsoon. The monsoon is here, at least in Burma, in you know, places like Bogor Division or Yangon Division, is wonderful for it, practice when it rains every day, oftentimes in the afternoon, and suddenly then you have the rain dropping onto the roofs, and it's so quiet, there's no major social activities going on, no weddings, nothing, and it's a perfect time for practice. Yes, Alan?
At some point in this retreat, would you consider talking about the fourth foundation of mindfulness and the hindrances in practical application to our meditation practices? It appears that with the fourth foundation, the hindrances are mentioned, and it appears also that there is a way to use the hindrances in skillful ways. Of applying mindfulness in non-attached, non-aversive ways. Is there some way that you might be able to speak to us about that?
Maybe, well, no.
A little bit.
Yeah, and Marcia is going to talk.
Because I'm not focusing.
And then I can add a little bit tomorrow. In the Dhamma discussion. Yes.
So you also mentioned before the purposes of mindfulness, the first you're with something and the second is protected. Could you expand on that? I wasn't familiar with that teaching. I hadn't heard it before.
With the help of Vidya, with effort, effort has a tendency to distance the mental defilements and also to block them, to block their path. And so when you block the path of unwholesomeness, the path of wholesomeness gets opened up. Wholesome mental states have a chance to arise. So that's the function or the work of the effort. And so the classical definition of mindfulness is that it's it has two manifestations. The first one is as a state of confrontation, a state of being face to face with the object of observation, visabhimukha bhava pachupatthana in Pali. And the second manifestation is as guardianship or protection, araka pachupatthana in the Pali scriptural language. And so, as explained earlier on, when mindfulness is really present, or is present from moment to moment to moment to moment to moment, with no gap in between, then unwholesome mental states have no chance to arise. And the result of this is that during the time when mindfulness is present in a continuous manner, the mind is protected. And protected from the arising of unwholesome mental states, which means no hindrances can arise. And in the case of concentration, the concentration suppresses the hindrances, so it doesn't give them a chance to arise. No, it's not that the hindrances are gone forever, but for the time being, they can't show their heads. And so it's those three mental factors that are working together and taking care of the hindrances, and then gradually allowing a meditator to move beyond the hindrances. I know. So from first being a victim of the hindrances to then reaching a point where the mind is quite free from the hindrances and all these wonderful mental states that we discussed earlier on, gladness and joy and so on and so forth, that then arise. So there's a very it's not a haphazard thing that is going on in the practice, but there is some very systematic development to the whole thing. Yes, Marcia.
I was going to say that experientially, with the concentration and mindfulness, in the way that you just spoke about it in relationship to the hindrances, not only are they suppressed or there's no space for them to come up, they're weakened in the process. If that's continued, those practices are continued with and are developed, and one is able to continue practicing that way, the hindrances get weaker and weaker.
Yeah.
What do you do though if the mind is deluded? You can be thinking that you're practicing mindfulness, but on a subtle level, the
wholesome
state pops up.
Yeah, sure. And then at a later point, you know, when some mindfulness comes back in, you realize, I've been, you know.
So that's where your mindfulness becomes sharp.
Yeah.
Experience, yeah.
I don't know. It's, you know, later on that we realize, you know, how deluded we've been, you know, earlier on. And that's a big surprise to many meditators. You think of, you go into a retreat, you think, oh, you're the greatest, and you know, you've got all these great diplomas and whatnot and degrees, and then after a while you realize how deluded you've actually, you know, or how impure the mind is. I know.
It's fortunate when that happens.
Yeah.
In a sense, very much so.
Otherwise, we're going to get it. Could I mention just one small thing? One of the ways that I said something about it last night, but the quality of energy, virya, effort, has a certain component in it of interest. And I sometimes call it interest energy. So I experientially myself and with students, that quality of interest in relationship to the hindrances, so the recognition of a hindrance arising and actually being interested in it with mindfulness. I mean, really being interested.
Mm.
It's like
enthusiasm
interest is what allows the wholesome connection and then the investigation and the falling,
very good point.
Of it, or the breaking up of it.
Yeah, right. The interest aspect from from point of view of Abhidhamma, that's your joy, your piti.
Yes,
I know.
It's
piti.
Yeah, it's such a different way of attending to difficulty.
Right.
And we're used to.
Right.
That the characterization of fourth foundation of mindfulness, of the investigation of interest.
Right.
And so, like, maybe to add a little bit as a reflection, you might suddenly take interest in the hindrances, suddenly thinking, well, they are present in the mind, in the stream of consciousness. They are going to come up during intensive practice. They are also going to come up during daily life. So why not suddenly get familiar with them? Why not study them while they're going on?
That's something that I found very helpful still, too. That the teacher basically said, think of them as dumbbells and you're a weightlifter. You know, a weightlifter doesn't think of their dumbbells as hindrances, but you keep working against them and you get stronger.
Yeah, that's a nice way.
Think of them as the dumbbells that you're working against and you get stronger.
Yeah.
Then you don't get to matter.
Right. No. And then there's less certain negativity or less resistance towards them. Yes,
you know, Jim. I have this concern that, you know, dwelling on the hindrance feeds it, and that the wiriya can actually. I'll give you an example. I was outside doing walking meditation, and then I was stepping through the door into the dining hall, and I looked to the kitchen. And I said, "Gee, I wouldn't mind a bite to eat right about now." At that moment. And instead of dwelling on it, going for it, I left it alone. And it didn't follow me. Normally what would have happened is I would have continued on, and the thought and the feeling and the salivation would have all started.
Right.
But it just never caught hold.
Yeah, right.
So rather than looking at it, focusing on it, feeding it, in effect, I just left it alone.
Yeah, but some moment of mindfulness must have been there.
There was the recognition of mindfulness.
Yeah, see, that's good enough. No, that then helped you to not act on it.
Yeah, I mean, I just sometimes I have a question about wiriya, the application of wiriya. Is it in unfailingly the right approach, or are there times when it's best not to apply wiriya, that just leave it, abandon it?
By all means, apply mindfulness, and then if you have the energy, then use it. And if it will probably depend on the circumstances. If effort is not needed, then don't use it.
Don't you have to be careful too? There's got to be neutrality there, because if you have to be careful about how you abandon it, otherwise it becomes an aversion.
That too, sure. Yes, Paul?
Do you recommend labeling hindrances when you see them arising?
Why not?
Is that part of
it? Oh, it's just naming something. No, naming, giving it a name, pronouncing the name in your mind. This is restlessness. Now I know what you are. And this makes a big difference. No, or with beginning meditators, all sorts of questions come up in the mind. Is this working? No, it's not working. Is it in accordance with the books I've read? No. And then what about the teachers here? How they don't know anything whatsoever. The meditator is caught up in this kind of thinking for quite some time, not realizing that this is doubt. This is the hindrance of doubt. And it may take a teacher to point out during interview that this is actually a mental factor of doubt, and kindly do consider it, labeling it, observing it, and knowing its nature, exploring its nature, or else sooner or later the meditator might get the point, realize for himself or herself I'm caught up in doubt, and then start to label it. So labeling helps. Not maybe not in each and every case, but it does. Yeah, it does. So it's already 8:42. Maybe this much for now. Shall we start the last sitting at 9:10? Or you prefer 9 o'clock or 9:10? 9:10.
Well, at a later time.
Ring
it at 9, and then they'll come in by 9.
Yeah, okay. Okay, that's all.